welcome to the Localization Fireside Chat. This is Robin Ayoub, and today we are recording another episode. For that, we are going to be talking about a specific topic for you today around the governance in the language industry. Today, the global language service market is a powerhouse in the global knowledge economy. Depending on the sources, obviously, it is valued somewhere between 70 to 80 billion and is projected nearly to double over the next decade or so. As digital globalization accelerates, demands for multilingual content and localization and interpretation services increases. Despite this growth, our industry has no single global standard setting body that represents the full breadth of stakeholders, from language services providers to enterprise buyers to language professionals worldwide. Instead, we operate in landscape with dozens, if not hundreds, of associations, federations, trade groups, spread across countries, disciplines, and technologies. This fragmentation, I think, has cost. It weakens our ability to speak a one voice on policy, regulations, quality standards, ethics, workforce development, and technology governance. The internet tech across sectors have solved some of those problems, similar problems, by creating multi-stakeholder governance forums, such as the Internet Governance, for instance, forum where governments and private sectors, civil society, and technical experts shape the norms for those sectors. There's no reason why an industry such as the language industry globally cannot have the same settings, if you will. Our goal today is to have a chat with my guest of honors, and we'll introduce them in a second here, on how, and if it's, you know, it's not a rehearse of history, but more to ask a forward-looking question and the real stakes that is involved right now for millions of practitioners around the globe and companies and individuals who are freelancers, who are contributing to the industry across thousands of languages. Do we need a unified global governing body for the language industry? If so, what does it look like and how do we get there? So to help me uncover all this, my good friends Sultan Ghaznawi and Carrie Fisher, Livermore, I appreciate you joining me. I really appreciate it. And thanks for taking part of this conversation. I know you both very well from a while now. We both have had conversations on one-on-one and through podcasts, publicly and privately. I know the thought, you know, around this, but for those who don't know you, and for the first time, some of our listeners, and believe it or not, we get new listeners every week on this channel. So for those who don't know you, if you don't mind, we'll start with Carrie. Just give us your story, get the audience to get to know you a little bit, and then we'll move to Sultan. Go ahead, Carrie.
Sure. So, hi, my name is Carrie Fisher. I've been in the localization industry for over 30 years. I'm currently at Subway as the Globalization Services Manager. I just celebrated my 9th anniversary. I can't believe how time has flown. I'm also a board member of Women in Localization. We're the largest female-led nonprofit in the loc industry. And just really excited to be here today. It's a fascinating topic and, you know, I don't know if we're going to solve the world's problems, but we're going to try.
We'll try. We'll give it a shot. Sultan, if you don't mind.
Good morning, Robin. Thanks so much for having me. Carrie, it's again a pleasure to be sharing the podium here with you. It's always an honor to be speaking on a forum like this about an important topic. I think I don't even know if I know all the answers or even can come up with any answers, but the goal is today that we will do some brainstorming and see where that goes. About myself, I've been in the language industry since 2006. I lead and we deliver language services to clients in North America, Europe, and Africa. And my interests remain in innovation within the language space, which does not really happen. It's always enforced upon us. And I think this is this conversation today will kind of touch on that piece and the problem of, or the major issue that in our industry we have, which is the definition of value. I think that's what I would like to take away from this conversation and share my own thoughts about it.
Well, thank you for contributing to the conversation, both of you. So let's get started with, let's get to the audience know, let them know, how is the landscape currently and what are we trying to improve? So let's start with, how would you describe the current ecosystem right now in the language industry, organizations, associations around the world today? And where do you think there are strengths and maybe gaps? And let's start with Carrie. We'll take get your take on this, and then we'll get Sultan's take on this, if you don't mind, Carrie. Go ahead.
It's tough. There's so many different organizations out there representing different groups within the localization industry. ILIA ATA, Gala. I mean, I was presenting at Vamos Juntos in Peru a couple years ago. And even within Argentina, you know, there were a lot of groups, there were a lot of different translation groups representing the same people in Argentina. And there was a discussion, hey, can we all just have one organization to, you know, represent all of us? So it's this way, I think, everywhere. You know, back in the day when I started, I remember going to my first LISA conference. I don't know if you remember LISA.
I do.
I think it was in 98 or, I don't know, 99, and it was in Boston. It was a snowstorm. It was actually hell to get there. But anyway, that was my first introduction to kind of like this standards group of, hey, we've got QA templates, you know, we've got project templates, we've got this, you can use this to, you know, have a base to start from. But it wasn't mandated. It was just a nice to have. And now I don't know what we've got. We've got Gala, which has helped, but there, you know, without a one standard for all, mm-hmm. like one, I didn't mean to do this, right? But I wore one ring to rule them all. No. is there one standard to rule them all? I don't know, but it's starting out rather fractured, and I don't know if we can actually come together and do this, but this is my take on it.
You know, the objective today, I guess, is to describe, you know, what our thoughts are on the current situation we have. And if nothing else, get the conversation going in the right direction. And hopefully, well, there'll be subsequent conversation in more forum like this one to amplify the topic, which is a very interesting topic. You mentioned LISA, but there are hundreds of these things, as you mentioned earlier. What's missing is, on the single voice from a global perspective, is things like, you know, you have it in the medical sector, you have it in the political sector, you have it in anywhere, like the UN, for instance, WTO, World Trade Organization, OECD, or equivalent that exists on the IT side, that exists in the aviation sector, that exists in the internet governance, right? And here you've got one of the smallest industry, and maybe that's the contributor factor for you being the smallest industry around, basically $70 billion from an industry size perspective, with all due respect, and I love you all together, in the, whoever works in the industry, if you work in the language industry, I love you. But let me tell you something, from a $70 to $80 billion, it's a rounding error in any other industry. When you're looking at trillions of dollars in other industry, it's still significant. And it employs a lot of people. But maybe we should take a look in, you know, have that internal look and figure out, like, is it the fragmentation that's contributing to this? Maybe we should have a solidified way of looking at this. Sultan, what's your take?
Robert, I have to say that fragmentation happens due to a number of reasons. And sadly, in our industry, there's a lot of disparities in terms of what people want. Greed, I would say, is the main driver for these disparities, because every region, every company is so protective of what they do and how they do it, although they're all doing the same thing. I worked in the telecom industry before I came to the language industry, and I was involved in a number of initiatives with the standardization. So some of the code today that runs on your phone, people early in 2000s, I was part of different committees and groups where we came up with things the way that mobile devices should operate and generate revenue for decades and decades. So there was harmony. I mean, we're talking about billions or hundreds of billions or trillions of dollars in telecom space that still continues to grow. Why? Because everybody was on the same wavelength and frequency, and they spoke the same language, no pun intended. But the point being that in our industry, we sell language services, but we don't speak the same language to each other. To Gary's point, there's a ton of associations and regional representations for whatever reason, and I've been to some of them. I find it sadly more red tape and more roadblock than anything else. I mean, I had to quit a number of associations because of the bickering and because of the, you know, the internal red tape that they were trying to put in because of interests of this one or two small companies here or some. And that to me is an obstacle to innovation. The only place I have found, to be honest with you, a very good degree of support and openness has been the ALC, or Association of Language Companies, which is based in the United States. And that leadership from the very beginning until this day has encouraged people to speak about the issue. They have hired lobbyists. Dr. Bill Rivers speaks on behalf of our industry. They have made significant changes and at the level of regulation. In fact, they not only speak on behalf of language companies, this is an association of language companies, but they also speak on the behalf of consumers of our services, not just the buyers, the people who actually end up reading that one page of translation and a hospital that's intended for them. The way I see it, and I mentioned this in a recent event with Carrie, actually I was not an attendee, I was just asking a question, and my thinking is that we are not in an industry. Language industry is not an industry. It's a collection of very fragmented, disparate associations and freelancers, and even the roles between a freelancer and a language company is not well established or defined, although they try to bring in standards. But overall, there's a lot of chaos. And when you have all this chaos and, you know, a lack of visibility into the future, because there's no leadership really, besides one or two associations that are trying to do their best, but everyone else is trying to compete with them. And as Carrie said, they're all trying to have conferences where they talk about the same things by the same people. The value gets lost. I think, agriculture is a really good example where farmers have been able to figure out a way to speak in the same voice and have representation globally and look after their interests. And that's actually, they are doing a massive service to the world by feeding people. But so do we. And, we are unable to justify that value that we deliver and then create a demand for that value and try to look after the people who consume what we deliver. So because of that, I think that our industry right now is in the state that it is. And one more important thing I want to add is that our industry is lagging behind right now because of traditional thinking, legacy thinking. We still believe in the per word model, and we still believe that we want the same volume of text that we got in early 2000s for translation. And we should be using the same tools, and why we hate machine translation and why AI is a bad thing. So, you know, when you combine all of that, that represents the state of our industry today. And I hate to say this, but if that thinking that brought us here doesn't change, our future will not change.
Yeah, what got us here is not going to get us there. Absolutely. Now, let's define the problem a little bit for those who are listening to this conversation right now. You and I, a lot of times, the three of us, we talk from a context that we're very familiar with the topic. For the audience who had never heard of this before, they think, what the heck these guys are talking about? So let's frame it a little bit. Let's define what the problem is. So you've hit the nail on the head, Sultan, in several in the current ecosystem that we currently have for all the, you know, all the organizations, all the associations that are around, where is there its strength and gaps? I mean, they must have some strength, because for the local communities, probably where they are, where these associations are, they might see some connection. They might see some, you know, I get to talk to people at least who speaks my language, who understands what I'm going through. But when you're thinking about it, the language industry being a global, then the message gets to a little bit not as strong as the regional message that you're trying to convey. So can we talk a little bit about strengths and gaps that we have currently in the ecosystem? Carrie?
Gosh, I think the strengths are the people. So we have a lot of smart people in our industry, and we get together, you know, a couple times a year. Mm-hmm. But again, it's for specific reasons, and it's put on by specific groups. You know, it's the Loc Worlds, it's the galas, it's the, you know, kind of the bigger industry, I don't know, machines.
Why do you think, Carrie, the fragmentation is a problem? Like, I know you've mentioned like the repeating of the message, but is there a bigger or an overall problem that the fragmentation is causing?
Well, everybody has their special interest that they're trying to safeguard or to push forward. And it depends on where they fall. I think Sultan, you know, touched on it. It's people want to safeguard their interests. They want to be the first to do this, the first to do that. And it's to, you know, protect their company or companies. There's no one governing voice that's neutral. We don't have that, I don't think.
So there's small interest groups that they represent, small organizations represent small interest groups, that kind of thing. And those small interest groups are, in your opinion, are not doing the larger objective of the industry a service. Actually, they're doing a disservice.
They're interested in their profits. They have stakeholders. Correct. They have profit sharing,
right.
Whatever it is, right?
That's
and I'm
right.
coming from a different side, right? I'm coming from the client.
You're on the buyer side, of course.
Yeah. But this is what I see. It's like the fastest, you know, to the finish line that keeps moving.
Yeah.
And that's just part of global commerce, right?
Of course. Yeah.
So. Yeah, we're kind of shooting ourselves in the foot by not having something neutral.
And you know, like if you're talking like dollar and cents, like let's say you have, I don't know, each country has like, I don't know, say 20 associations. And I think if we're living in Canada, I think there's more than 20 just in Canada, right? Association. If you take the provincial associations, with the various local associations, various interest groups. I think we're over 20. And each member of that association pays a little bit of money into the association and, you know, give it a little bit of money to stay viable, I guess, for the lack of a better word. And you multiply that across many countries out there. Now you end up with thousands of associations, thousands of organizations. Each one of those associations has, in my opinion, a set of priorities that they're trying to push forward. And their priorities are microscopic in terms of they're looking at it from their own lens, in their own jurisdiction, in their own views, and they're not seeing other things. They're not seeing what's beyond. And now we're going through the transformation, as Sultan alluded earlier, technology, the AI deployment, or any other technology may come down the road. And we're seeing that as the big bad wolf coming in, because that's going to transform a bunch of things. And people are now, I've seen it here, at least on our local side, when times are good, nobody wants to come into the association and have a conversation with anybody. When times are bad, you've got everybody rolling to the association, say, help me. You see that, but there is no unified way of addressing this at a global level. What are the top 10 priorities? As Sultan mentioned earlier, for instance, the telecom. In the telecom industry, they created the 802.11 TCP/IP protocol that governed every communication between every network devices. Those protocols created for a reason. This is how you communicate with a particular device. And of course, these protocols get updated all over time. There is no single protocol, and to Sultan's point, in the language industry today that says you will use this particular protocol to do translation. It doesn't matter what language it is. It doesn't matter what technology you're using. That's irrelevant. But the output needs to follow this particular protocol. None of that. People are working on ISO and all that
exception.
Stuff.
The ISO standards.
Yeah, I know, but they're not coded. They're not coded. There are a document that sits in somebody's desk.
We all use those ISO codes, all three of them.
Not, with all due respect, yes, you do in your case. And I respect that. But I don't know. I'm a customer, right? Consider me a customer. Yeah, you're telling me ISO, fine. I'm still finding errors. What ISO are you using? Am I like crazy? I don't know. What do you think, Sultan?
No, I think attempts were made, to Kerry's point, to standardize things in the language industry. In particular, when Lisa tried to do something with QA, there would be a standard model. They invented the XLIF protocol, which allows you to transfer, basically make translation portable from application to application. And that's language agnostic. Same with the TMX standard for term bases and so forth. So there were attempts, and those are we must recognize those, because a lot of people spend a lot of time and hard work and get that done. So they should always be recognized. And today, those XLIF standards are being used in the AI space for training artificial intelligence models and so forth. But to your point as well, Kerry, ISO has done an amazing job, not just the ISO 9001, but we also deal with ISO at the business practice level. So we have ISO 17100, 185.87 for machine translation, and then there's a bunch of other for interpreting and so forth. They all try to bring in harmony and standardization. So that's the technical aspect of it. Yes, attempts were made. Are they good enough? We are probably 5% of the way there, 95% still. We haven't defined any. We don't even know what we need to standardize. And most of the time, we do these things, sadly, because of external pressures, because Google or Cisco or somebody is doing work a certain way now. They want us to standardize a specific response. We need to create an API system. We need to do something else. It's not because we are being innovative. It's not because one afternoon a bunch of people sit down and say, hey, how about we solve this problem of how we handle terminology and make it standardized and get the entire industry to buy into that, and that makes everyone's lives easier. We don't do that. And when it comes to translation tools, sadly, I don't know where this comes from, but majority of translation companies in the world are at the mercy of tool makers, which there's only three or four commercial ones. Open source in our industry is vilified. It's bad. So there's no innovation. Nobody can invent something, in the open source and give it out. I have to recognize we localized a few years ago. They purchased a company that had a TMS called Global Site, and they open sourced it. I was part of that. That, if we were to create something like that and make that code available to others and enable others to do business better, and that brings in the standardized practices, because most of those people are vendors of larger organizations. larger organizations, like in order to build walls around themselves as much as possible. And those walls sadly create fragmentation and divisions and so forth. And so in our industry, everything is driven from the outside. Everything is driven by greed. We are responsive. We are not innovative. We don't look into the future. We look into today. And we love to complain how things are not working, right? I do this all the time. I complain, but I try to solve things from my perspective, as small as it is. I sit down with people sometimes and then I say, how there is this problem? How can we solve it together? Maybe we can get ALC or someone. And believe it or not, ALC actually tackles some of those challenges, some of those problems. Speaking of regional associations and representations, there were times when hundreds of thousands of dollars are spent on something that's a replica of something else, but just because they want to associate it with their region or with their country or association, they are taking membership money that should go towards innovation and wasting it. I'm saying again, wasting it on paying fees for something that should not exist, that has no relevance, and they're forcing people to accept it. I think that that's where you're killing or stifling innovation. You are actually abusing the membership funds. And as an association, you have no place to exist. Might as well actually move away and let someone else innovate. We've had some of the larger associations in our industry, without going into details, they still continue to have very large industry events in Europe and different continents, whatever. But where's the relevance? I've a couple of times submitted papers to speak about a topic like this, for example, and suggest certain ideas, but they were turned down because they thought, the association leadership thought, that it's not relevant to their membership. So with all of that said, you know, I think this industry is at the right place to be right now. Why? Because we will see shedding of a lot of people or organizations, sadly, that do not wish to innovate, that do not wish to go into the future, who wish to bring back and that nostalgia of how they did, you know, translation over certain tools and so forth. That will not happen. My message for the translation community, which is at the heart of this entire ecosystem, right? Our translators basically power our industry. My message for them is to look beyond what you're told by these translation companies. Innovate, see what's happening outside of this industry and adapt to that. And then if you have those skills, a lot of these translation companies sooner or later will not be there, or the ones that will be there, they will adapt in a way that they will not be recognizable. So your skills will be very useful to them. That's the new generation of language services providers, I would say. But how will it look like? I don't know. I don't have a crystal ball, but I think that what we have right now is unsustainable, and it shouldn't exist the way it is. It's post-Cold War era, and we are still trying to live in it.
I agree. We need to look forward to what is next. How do we bring all this together? I do like the idea of moving forward and developing something brand new, because we want to match what the future is going to look like. And everybody, not just every person, but every body or every industry evolve with time and evolve in a way that meets the future demand or future challenges. The biggest thing that we should not forget is there's a lot of legacy knowledge that could be repurposed for the future. Nobody is saying here or encouraging that ditch everything you know now and learn something new for the future. What we're saying is, what Sultan's trying to say is, take what you've learned, adapt it, and move it to the future. And that's the only way we are going to evolve. Now, I do agree that there are some companies out there, many of them actually, still operate in that legacy mode. Give me the words, email them to me, I'll send them to you back in an email, and then I'll ask the employees to figure out an invoice for you. I'll send the invoice, and we'll send a pigeon to send it to you. There's a lot of that stuff going on there. Which is okay. I guess it works in your environment. Nobody's saying if you're making money, you're doing okay, and you're happy where you are. Believe it or not, there's a lot of people. Actually, a few people reached out to me and they're saying, I don't want to grow. I just want to sustain it the way it is. I don't want to lose money. I just want to stay where I am. I'm happy. I'm comfortable. You know, help me stay flat, if you will. Flat is good in some people's mind. I'm not saying everybody, but people are saying right now, flat is good. It wasn't good a few years ago. Everybody was on a trajectory like, I want that hockey stick of graph, you know, of revenue going up. I want that hockey stick. Now, I guess we're in a different world. When we imagine, and this is the purpose of our conversation, when we imagine just think about it as a white sheet of paper and you're drawing something on it. you're trying to build something. When you're imagining a governance body that controls, or not controls, but that sets few things that could, of the language industry globally, what would that look like in your mind? What does it look like? At least from an imagination perspective. We're not here to, you know, describe exactly what it's going to look like, because we don't know. We're just trying to imagine what it would look like.
I don't know. There's so many maybe people or organizations that don't want this and would never adhere to it. I don't know how, even if it was this beautiful white paper thing and everything looked marvelous, there will always be people who say, nope, this doesn't work for me. And how would we possibly get, you know, a quorum, if you will? So I don't mean to bat this down before we even get started, but I don't know what the white paper would look like. I don't know. I don't have a good foundation. The only thing I can think of is, you know, starting with something that is already known. And I talk about the ISO standards, but there's also the Unicode Consortium. What role could they possibly play? I'm actually speaking to the CEO on Tuesday. Next week, we were introduced, which is great. It's kind of, you know, it's all coming together, right?
And when are you speaking to him? On Wednesday? Maybe we'll publish before Wednesday and you can show him this conversation.
Tuesday. I'm speaking to her on Tuesday. It was supposed to be right after this meeting, but she had to cancel. But I think there might be some, I don't know if overlap is the right word, but a starting point with the Unicode Consortium. But Sultan, I think you have probably better idea.
Thanks, Gary. I agree with you. Yes, it's almost impossible to whiteboard this, because the interests are so varied. And because of the global nature of this industry, everybody has very different expectations and wants. But you can define a common denominator. I think we all agree that what we deliver solves a problem. And that problem is for someone to understand something, right? Now, if I were to define an industry, and this is, again, my personal view of things, I would actually center this industry around the person reading that document, that page. So just like an accounting association, for example, looks after, you know, things that are related to finances and the people who get affected, whether it's they're doing their annual taxes and so forth, or if you're looking at associations related to healthcare, for example, patient is what they're focusing on, right? In our industry, we need to do that and move away from focusing on our own interests. Because once we look after the interests of the people, the end users, the outcomes dependent people, then our interests also become very clear. Because at the end of the day, we should be about giving them value, protecting them. And as a result, you know, we will find our place, I think. But right now, that's not happening. Right now, for translation companies, the buyers are important. Buyers are enterprises that buy services. But what do those buyers do with that translation? It goes to somewhere, it gets published somewhere, but nobody cares about who reads it at that point, right? For our colleagues in the freelance and the supply side of things, selling to translation companies, for them, it's important what translation companies are buying. And it seems like this whole thing is very miscalculated and very misplaced in terms of where the focus should be. But if we start working backwards from the end user's point of view, then I think all of us will find our place. And regardless of where we are in the world, we will all agree on how we should look after those people who, at the end of the day, read the words that we type.
Yeah, that's a major shift, because you have an entire industry that's built around the translator, you know, the operational model. That's, if you look at any company, and we have a client representative on the phone here with us, on the call with us, but mostly, most translation companies, everybody who've been, you know, 19,000 companies out there, they started with the idea of saying, hey, I'm a translator. If you need my services, come to me. And that's it. The transaction is over. No, in most of the conversations or most of the businesses in the language industry have been developed that way. A freelancer who started a smaller company and grew it from there, or started with an idea that I want to do translation, and they mushroomed from there, which is good. I mean, it served its purpose at the time, right? But now what we're thinking about, and you know, there are a few associations out there, they call themselves the OTIAC one, for instance. The motto is, or the purpose of them as per the legislation, is for the protection of the consumer. That's, you know, back to your point there, Sultan. You reminded me of that, because that's their, you know, if you read their website, that's what they're there for, is for the protection of their consumer. Now, they don't know. I mean, I do agree with you that the outside in general, the protection for the consumer or not, but the outside look to the inside, it's much better than here I am, I built it, and you come in and do business with me, versus an industry that's kind of flip its thinking to think about the consumer, to think about the translator, to think of, sorry, the people who are reading your content and people who are buying your content. You got to give those some assurances as what they're buying. I get the ISO, Kerry, and there's a lot of people they use, and I know a few of them, they use ISO as a, you know, here's the flag. I'm carrying the ISO flag. You should trust me. They still make errors like the rest of the people. Make sense?
Absolutely. And I want to add to that, Robin, because, you know, another thing that in our industry, we most of the time complain about is that nobody knows us. Well, do you know who designed the chair you're sitting on? Probably you don't, right? Does the designers, chair designers or bed frame designers of IKEA have their own association? If they do, what are they promoting? What are they looking after? You know, what do they cover? I think in our industry, we need to take that type of a perspective. We shouldn't be just simply creating an association just for the sake of it.
Or patting ourselves on the back, is that what you mean? Just say it.
Exactly. Right? So what we can do is, I think if we were to go back from to the drawing board and create everything from scratch, I would create something around the customer, the consumer of our services. The millions of words that we translate, Kerry, in your case, for example, your organization, I don't know how many words it pumps out every year and how many languages, but the thing that you created in 2020, 2021, all of that text exists somewhere. Does anybody read it? What was it created for, right? Like it solved the problem of the day at the time. But as I think our focus should be on how to create longevity of content. How should we make sure that something, you know, we protect our buyers too, so that we give them advice that the translation should, you know, be used as for as many years as possible. It shouldn't be for one, although it creates volumes for us, which is great for work. But at the same time, if we're looking about value versus volume, we need to see where the enterprise, for example, can maximize its dollar investment with translation and localization. It shouldn't just simply be translate, you know, 10 million words a year for the sake of it. I think that kind of thinking, it reminds me of the TV show The Office, because they do a lot of things without thinking. They're selling paper because they have to sell paper, right? We need to change that. We are in that environment, seriously.
I think we're living the office. Oh, you made me laugh. I just remember this guy standing by the Xerox machine, photocopying paper for what? I don't know. Told me to photocopy paper.
Yeah, so sometimes actually my kids are big fans of The Office, and my daughter reminds me that Dwight Schrute says that how I'm going to be smartest to think about doing something. And if I ask myself, if a stupid person does this, I will not do that. You know, but in our industry, we should kind of be doing the same thing. Do other industries do these things? You know, are there ways that we can reduce waste, for example, and we can become friends with regulatory officials and the government and help them reduce waste. And as a global entity, basically, that would be goodwill that we are offering to our buyers, our consumers. And in the process, we generate work that actually delivers values to people around the world, as opposed to just pumping out content that gets translated.
Correct. Now, just a question for both of you. The stage we are at right now in terms of where the technology is transforming the industry and where we are right now in our business life cycle as an industry, there is a lot of conversations that I've talked to a few experts. And they talk about the post-localization era. So are we in a position right now with all the tech that's coming around to continue down the road of try to build something on the foundation that we currently have? Or do we need to scrap everything that we currently have and build something brand new?
I don't think it's possible to scrap everything and start something from new. We have to build on what we've got. And, you know, it's funny. So, Sultan, I was writing things down as you were talking, you know, protection of the consumer, creating content that lasts and not just creating content for the sake of creating content. And also, you're assuming that the consumer knows what they want.
True.
Right? I'm a client. I don't know much about technology. I have a degree in French. Not that that means I can't learn or I can't become an expert at AI or whatever else is going to come our way. I have to rely on other people, and I'm a team of one. The realities have to be baked into the equation at some point. That
is it about creating value? If Kerry, is it about creating value? Like yes. for the companies who are in our industry, instead of becoming transactional, I think the question should be is, what value am I creating for our customers, for our market? And what problem am I solving? You know, the content, we talk about the content journey all the time. What did this content do? Did it achieve what it set out to do? If you're putting it on a website, did it do something positive for your
website?
Did it convert? Did it draw people to read it better? Did I increase my revenue? And, you know, this is when we move from an afterthought as an industry to a more integral part of the business as an industry. Because now you're a contributor to a business versus an admin cost on a spreadsheet for a business.
Right. That's the only thing I think of is how to create value for our guests. We are guest first, you know, Subway is a, you know, guest first focus company, because if we don't treat them correctly or nicely, they're not going to come back. I don't care how good our sandwiches are. So I have to make sure that the translated content resonates, reaches the guest, and the sandwich artists understand what it, you know.
And there is this added issue where the most of the conversation we talk about are happening in an area where North America or Western Europe or East conversations, right? They're centered in the more where the economy is predominantly. From a language perspective, we can't think that way because there's thousands of languages, there's thousands of demographics out there, there's thousands of communities that are not represented in this conversation. I had one yesterday. It was quite an eye-opening. You know, there are millions of users, for instance, they're still using Google in English in their local communities because the translation of that, it is not logical to them. They don't approve it. It is not translated in a way that the local community can use it. Mm. It is true in a lot of cases that these things are happening, and we talk about it in North America, Canada, United States, and France, UK, Germany, etc. But the missing piece of it is, let's say, I don't know how many dialects in the Arabic language or how many dialects are in the Indic language, Sub-Saharan language, Asian languages. That conversation, maybe it's happening on their side. But when we talk about a global body, we need to include all these into the global body right now. Right now, they are represented internally in their own jurisdictions because that's the only way they know about it. Did we solve anything so far? I don't think we did, but I think the conversation is worthwhile having. I believe so.
Robin, I also have to your point, I want to add here that the fact that so many people in the world today are not online, and Meta is spending billions of dollars to bring more people online, and SpaceX, for example, not SpaceX, what's the name of the satellite firm that they have?
Starlink.
Thank you. Starlink is trying to bring more people online globally. And as an industry, if we haven't plugged in there to do our job, once the technical infrastructure enables them to connect to the global digital community, there's no conversation, no thought from our industry on how we are going to do our part. These people who come online, are we going to allow these mega companies to force them to communicate in English? Or are we as an industry being proactive and have plans on how we're going to deal with these remote communities in Africa or parts of Asia? Did we develop tools to handle that? Do we have the manpower, the resources? No. If we had a federation or an umbrella organization that would actually look into this global problem, we would probably be meeting with the United Nations, identify problems with education, problems with technology access, and all kinds of things, and work with our partners like Starlink and others, or Meta, for example, to develop AI tools, to develop accessibility tools and other things. And as a result, generate demand for all kinds of things that is knowledge-based or information-based. But that's too long of a thinking that our industry should be doing, and we don't have that yet. I remember about 4 years ago, 5 years ago, I told people that there is something called generative artificial intelligence that's coming up. We were part of that, the initial development of one of the first models with one of the providers. And what I saw was quite interesting. I wanted a conversation around that in the language industry. And most people, actually, the rebuttal was that machine translation is AI. It's been there forever. What are you talking about, generative AI, right? And today, people are discussing that. I think that conversation should have taken place in early 2020s during the pandemic. We had a lot of time to brainstorm on how we would shape ourselves, our services, our approach to delivering value with this new tool. It's too late now. So what is right now being cooked in the technology space outside of our industry it will hit us probably in 3 years' time, but then it will be a surprise again. Even then we will be talking about generative AI, not about what's coming after generative AI, which is probably...
What is coming so we can all plan?
I think it's multimodal AI that's going to take over. And multimodal is a combination of text, speech, video, and a bunch of other things, sensor data included, which will power robotics. So you can actually deploy a robot in the sub-Saharan African region, and it will charge itself, it will get things from the satellite, it will have sensors, it will receive sensor data from the oceans, from the desert, and it can do a lot of things, and it can understand local people speaking and so forth. Where's our space in that? Where do we fit, right? This thing may or may not materialize, like Metaverse, for example, that was recently scrapped by Meta. We need to be thinking in those lines. We need to prepare ourselves.
Yeah, because most of the innovation in this industry comes from outside the industry. You hit the nail on the head. You know, when we create something, it is a reaction to what's happening on the outside. I mean, did we invent AI? No. What's his name? The big YouTube personality there got fed up. Mr. Beast, I guess his name, got fed up with the language industry and went open his own AI company. Say, I'm too costly, too cumbersome, too slow. I'm doing my own thing. And opening his own AI company, doing his own videos. The technologies that you are talking about, the avant-garde of the, you know, the frontier of technology development, the language industry is not there. And by the time the language industry, I'm not criticizing, but I'm just stating a fact. By the time the language industry react to those technologies, it's too late because you were not part of the design. Now you are a consumer of that technology. Now you are reacting to that technology and you're behind the eight ball already. By design, you're behind the eight ball.
So how can we possibly hope to form an organization that is ahead of the eight ball?
But this is what the purpose of the governing body at a global level that gets inserted into the idea development of these technologies. That would be one of the purposes, in my opinion. Get inserted at the top end of the food chain where the technology development is taking place, not to become a consequences of it. You're trying to become... We've always been like an afterthought in anything. Like, you know, it's two parts. It's part because the entire industry creates I'm not criticizing anybody. It's part of who we are as a nature of the industry. We create this comfort zone, you know, and we create these processes around the comfort zone. And please don't disturb my life, because if you're adding one step in the process, I've seen people go to, like, you know, get psychology support because they've added a couple of steps into their processes. It's an emotional reaction. You're dealing with, if you do personality index diagnostics on most people that works in the industry, not everybody, most people that works in the industry, you'll understand why. I did that. I don't know. I did about 1,000 of these things. You'll understand why. They all have the same profile from a personality perspective. One day I'll write the book. It's here. I would write the book one day. It is absolutely phenomenal to see it working. To see how these people, and again, no pun intended and no disrespect to anybody, and I'm not trying to hurt anybody's feeling. There is a huge inherited personality traits in these individuals when that comfort zone is being created through academia, I would believe. I don't know where it started from. To get to a point where if you introduce a tiny little change, it will disrupt their life. Like they were hit by a Titanic in the middle of the ocean. And that's the consequences of adopting new technology that Sultan is talking about. That's why we wait for it. You know, we've seen it. I wait for it to come in. We'll deal with it when it comes in. Too late. It's too late.
There's almost a parallel here. Localization is thought of last in the whole product cycle sometimes. And
so, I mean, we put it that way. It's by design. I mean, take a look at the pricing model that was created 30, 40 years ago. Who came up with that genius idea? Put things by per word? That's the dumbest move I ever thought about. Go to a lawyer. Tell him, hey, I want to pay you based on how many words in your contract. See how that works.
Kerry, let me ask you a question from a buyer's perspective. So if Subway or any enterprise for that matter, if budget was not an issue, if time was not an issue, what would ideally your organization want to do with language?
Boy, that's a good question. Go into more countries than we are now. I don't think we're in Africa. We're not on the African continent, I don't believe. And maybe there's not, a need for it. Maybe people don't want Subway sandwiches or whatever we've got. If budget were not an issue, yeah, I think we would explore a lot more maybe than we already are today.
Where does translation sits for Subway? Is it at the expense level or at the revenue generation level? Do you consider translation as a revenue or as expense?
Expense, because we do come after it. Their restaurant businesses are so different than anything else I've ever been in. I come from the software world, so it was kind of a shift for me. It's all about where can Subway thrive?
Yeah. Is there a direct formula between if you translate, I generate revenue or no?
No, it's an assumed thing. If we're going into this country, we will translate. It's just done. There's no ROI or any of that stuff. It's just part of doing business, which is kind of nice.
Yeah.
In that sense, I don't have to justify anything. It's like, if you want customers in Korea, then we have to translate into Korean.
So from your perspective, like if you're looking for a supplier to deal with, do you prefer somebody who belongs to an association or does it matter to you or no?
What kind of associate? What do you mean?
You know, language association. Do you want them to be part of ALC? Do you want them to be part of another? Is that factors in your decision or no?
No, it doesn't. I have individual linguists for some of my languages.
But that says a lot though. You know, this is what when we talk about the value of these association and you're a buyer talking to Sultan and I right now. Mm-hmm. And when you say to us, like, no, it's not a factor. It means either the association did not do their job. If they have a mandate to do the job, maybe that's not their job at all. I have no idea. But what I'm talking about is they're not contributing positively to the image of that translator or the language service company to be selected by a customer. Like if I go to a customer right now, or something goes to a customer and say, hey, listen, I'm an ALC member or I'm a, you know, Canadian Language Industry Association member. What do you think that's going to do to that decision? It won't resonate. Most likely it won't resonate. Some people would, I don't know. But most people would think, okay, what's your price?
What can you do for me?
Is that correct? Or am I not too much coffee this morning?
No. I think that to me, it's correct. What's important to me is the translations are done to my specifications and our guests' expectations, whether they belong to an industry association or not. It's not part of my decision making. So now that I'm thinking about it, right, I'm like, okay, so when I hired so-and-so or yada, yada. No, I wanted to make sure the translations were right.
And you don't care about what technology they use, what tools, as long as the translation comes to you, correct?
Correct.
Yeah. Yeah. That's an
I want to actually expand on that. So Carrie, what you just mentioned, I think it's you expressed to everybody that's involved in delivering these services how much of the things we do in our industry that is not mandatory. That would be considered fluff in a way. I went to a hospital recently in Toronto. In Toronto, I'm very proud of it. It's a city that's very diverse and multicultural, and they take languages seriously. I don't know how many, there's like over 300 languages spoken in the city. And one of the main hospitals at the heart of Toronto, I walk in, and then there is a sign in multiple languages that says something to the fact that if you're looking for an interpreter, you have to point to something like that. And it was in multiple languages. I speak seven languages, and at least the four of them, the characters that move from right to left or backwards. So basically, nobody thought to check that this makes sense or not. And I don't know how long that sign had been there. I don't know if anyone even bothered to complain. When I talk about being focused on the end user, in this case, we're talking about a patient who probably comes in pain and sick, and they are not going to complain about the sign being showing up backwards, right? So I think for an organization, including for Subway, that type of a user experience is more important to be dealt with, to be correct, to be 100% compared to which you know association you're a member of, which legacy standards do you support or you subscribe to, and so on and so forth. I think if I'm correct here, the value to you is that a Subway guest coming into a restaurant feels like they receive everything 100%, including in their own language. The way that a salesperson speaks with them in Portuguese, let's say somewhere in Portugal, the signage and everything should appeal to them in that manner and make them feel like they are dealing with Subway brand from the moment that they walk into the restaurant until they leave the restaurant. Correct?
Correct.
If that's the value that we are bringing, that's not the focus of our industry today. And I argue that we need to study that more. We need to learn more about customer experience. We need to learn more about how we make people feel with text and speech, right? If Subway wants people to come in there and then come back again, what type of language should we use to entice them that they should come back, right?
Yep.
They do that in other industries. Marketing, for example, is huge on this. But as Robin said, our industry does not only cover marketing, but we deal with legal, technical, with all kinds of things. But it's the same set of rules that can apply to all of them. And that is not just to protect the end user. For protection, we've got the provincial orders who act like regulators, basically. But here is to look after them in terms of making them understand so they can make the right decision for them, even if that involves buying the right sandwich from Subway.
100%. The industry has defined the problem that we're solving wrong. Normally, every industry says, here's the problem, I'm set out to fix it. And the problem in generally in any other industry, it relates directly to the consumer, directly to the customer of your who's consuming your product. Our industry defined the problem completely wrong. We've defined the problem as give me a text. It is in English. I'm going to shift it to you to another language. That problem I'm going to solve for you. And that's where my responsibility ends as a customer, as a supplier. However, from the eyes of the customers, such as Kerry and all the other customers out there, that's not the problem. That's not the problem that you're suffering from. That's part of it. That's only single part of it. The other part of it is how do I create value using this particular translated text to my customers, to your end users, to your guests at your restaurants? That question has not been answered. And I agree with Sultan. We need to take a look at what is it, what is the value that we're bringing in as an industry and redefine what that is. I interviewed somebody yesterday from South Africa. We talked about a lot about creating stories. Our industry doesn't tell the story correctly either. We're not serious about, we're building and they come kind of an industry, a translation agency. I'm located on this block, on this corner. You need me? Okay, come see me. Or talk to me on, hey, here's my email address. We're not good at telling a good story because the industry doesn't do a lot of marketing and we're not good at doing a lot of marketing. Look around you. Look at the other industry, pharmaceutical, automotive, tech. Marketing up the wazoo on these guys. These guys, they do a ton of marketing. Our industry doesn't do marketing. We don't market ourselves. And then when we are telling the stories about our industry, we're telling it from the wrong angle. My translator, here's the famous one. I've worked so hard on this translation. I stayed up till 11 o'clock at night doing your translation. That's the story. That's the exact story I'm hearing. Well, thank you so much. I appreciate your hard work. Here, I pay you for that. Thank you. I move on. This story, how did you get involved as a translator to solve somebody's problem or help somebody save life or whatever the consequences of your translation down the road, we didn't get involved in. How did we do today so far? I know we're over the hour, so I can talk to you guys for a day, but we're not going to do that. You have other things to do. You want to get rid of me as soon as possible. I get it. I see the look on Sultan's face.
I've got time for you. It's Friday. And I'm really enjoying this
schedule. I had a panic attack. No, I don't have anything.
You know, it's really good that we're talking about something that maybe we are getting wrong. Our work is not about words and sentences. I think our words should be about, you know, delivering value from Subway to its customer. And we enable Subway to do that to its customer. It shouldn't be that I'm delivering value to Subway. No, I'm helping Subway deliver value to its customer. If we can define our role in that way, I think our industry has a place with every major industry in the world. And there are certain places I think our industry should not even pursue. For example, we should not be going after places like where low exposure text and social media or whatever. We should allow AI to handle, and we should welcome AI to take care of that. In fact, we should promote AI for those type of things. But places where an organization is interacting with its customer, whether it's a hospital, a restaurant, or a government agency, we need to describe ourselves how we sit between the customer and between the provider of that service. And as opposed to us right now being the back end people just translating content.
I appreciate it. And on that note, I would like to complete our conversation today. I really appreciate your time, both of you, Sultan, Kerry. Always welcome to come back and give us your perspective. The audience loves to hear from you. I love to hear from you. And I appreciate your input. This is very valuable to me and to many. And I will keep you posted on when I post and I'll tag you in every social post I do. So you'd be abreast of what's going on out there. To the audience, I want to thank you so much for joining me today. I really appreciate your listening in. If you're coming on our audio channels, if you're coming on YouTube, thanks for watching us. And please keep an eye on our a blog post, robinayoub.blog, where I summarize these conversations into a short blog where you don't have to read or listen to an entire hour. Maybe you like to listen to an entire hour conversation between me and Kerry and Sultan. I leave that up to you, but if you prefer a less time-consuming, consumable part of our conversation, check out the blog. Thanks so much, and I'll see you guys at the next episode. Appreciate it.